From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Cindy Sheehan is back. She's calling for the impeachment of President Bush. She says she'll run against House Speaker Nancy Pelosi if Pelosi refuses to begin the impeachment process.
I think it was totally inappropriate for Speaker Pelosi to take impeachment off the table. And I think to restore our rule of law, democracy, and justice, we need to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney.
Today, a debate on whether the Democrats should attempt to impeach President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney.
I believe that the single most important thing Democrats can do to repair the damage George Bush has done to the country is to retake the White House. And my concern, I think the concern of a lot of Democrats who oppose impeachment, is that impeachment would pose a grave risk to Democrats' effort to take back the White House. It's as simple as that.
Dan Gerstein is a former aide to independent Senator Lieberman of Connecticut. We'll also be speaking with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. Then we go to Oaxaca, Mexico, where tensions are rising again between the state and APO, the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca.
I went back to see what had happened, and they told me that my husband was wounded. I found him on the ground in the middle of the street, drowning in his own blood.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House congressional dispute over testimony on the firing of U.S. attorneys and the warrantless domestic spy program has intensified. Four Democratic members of the Senate Judiciary Committee want a special prosecutor to investigate whether Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez committed perjury in testimony this week. Gonzalez told the Senate panel Tuesday there was no internal White House dissension over the spy program's legality. He also denied trying to pressure then-Attorney General John Ashcroft to sign off on the program as he lay in a hospital bed recovering from major surgery. Gonzalez says their meeting dealt with other intelligence activities, but his comments were directly contradicted by FBI Director Robert Mueller. Testifying before Congress Thursday, Mueller said the spy program was indeed discussed in Ashcroft's hospital room and that Mueller himself had expressed serious reservations about the warrantless spying. Meanwhile, the Senate Judiciary Committee subpoenaed senior White House advisor Karl Rove and presidential aide J. Scott Jennings for the testimony about the dismissal of federal prosecutors. In Iraq, at least 60 people were killed in violence around the country Thursday. 25 people were killed and 75 wounded in a massive car bombing in central Baghdad. 8 U.S. soldiers were killed, including 4 in Diyala, where tens of thousands of troops are launching attacks. More allegations have emerged of physical abuse and poor conditions of workers building the massive U.S. embassy in Baghdad. On Thursday, 2 American civilian contractors told the House Oversight Committee foreign workers were tricked into coming to Iraq, then barred from leaving after contractors took their passports. The Kuwaiti firm First Kuwaiti is overseeing the $600 million project. Its status to be the largest U.S. diplomatic mission in the world. American contractor John Owens said he found the working and living conditions for the workers, quote, deplorable. Owens says the workers lived in tightly packed trailers and were denied basics, including shoes and gloves. They worked 12-hour days, 7 days a week for as little as $240 a month. Owens says workers were verbally and physically abused and docked pay for minor infractions. The parents of a U.S. soldier who killed himself after returning home from military duty in Iraq have sued the U.S. government for negligence. Joyce and Kevin Lucy say their son, Jeffrey, hanged himself after the U.S. military ignored his depression. In late May 2004, Jeffrey was involuntarily committed to a military veterans hospital after he ignored his family's pleas to seek help. The hospital discharged him after a few days. He killed himself 3 weeks later. His father came home to find his son had hung himself with a hose in the cellar of their house. The dog tags of 2 Iraqi prisoners he said he was forced to shoot unarmed lay on his bed. The Lucy suit follows another case in which 2 veterans' rights groups say the Department of Veterans Affairs delayed and denied veterans help for disabilities such as post-traumatic stress disorder. In Afghanistan, negotiations are continuing between tribal elders and Taliban kidnappers holding 20 South Korean church workers hostage. One of the hostages was killed Wednesday after a deadline passed. The Taliban wants to exchange the workers for the release of rebel prisoners. Meanwhile, in South Korea, activists gathered in Seoul to call for the hostages' safe return and the withdrawal of South Korean troops from Afghanistan. This is activist Park Jo-yun.
The U.S. occupied Afghanistan and continued waging a war. Then South Korean troops joined them in the name of an anti-terrorism war. That's the main reason why the hostage situation happened. And the Taliban should immediately free the 22 South Korean hostages promptly and safely.
There are 22 South Korean hostages. In the occupied territories, a longtime Fatah insider has resigned his post as the chief Palestinian security official. Mohammed Dahlan says he's resigning on medical grounds, but critics say his departure is linked to his failure to prevent the Hamas takeover of Gaza last month. Dahlan has also faced accusations of corruption and human rights abuses during his time in the Palestinian government. In Australia, an Indian doctor detained over the failed car bombings in Britain has been freed after prosecutors admitted his arrest was a mistake. Prosecutors have withdrawn all charges against Mohammed Hanif after finding he had no connection to the case. In Cuba, more than 100,000 people gathered in the central city of Camagüey to mark the 54th anniversary of the attacks that ignited the Cuban Revolution. Acting Cuban leader Raul Castro said Cuba had suffered major setbacks since his brother Fidel Castro handed off power last year. Raul Castro also said Cuba would negotiate with the U.S. once the Bush administration leaves office.
For that date, a year from now, we will be better prepared to resist and overcome on all fronts, including the defensive. Also by then, there will have been elections in the United States, and the terms of the current president of that country will have ended, as well as his dangerous administration, characterized by backward and fundamentalist thoughts, which do not allow for rational analysis of the world.
This year's event also marked 1 year since Fidel Castro's last public appearance. Pakistan has rebuked the Bush administration for recent comments asserting the U.S. would attack areas inside Pakistan if deemed necessary to fight al-Qaeda militants. This is the Pakistani foreign minister, Khurshid Mahmood Kasuri.
Such statements are irresponsible and they should not be made. In fact, they are counterproductive to the sort of effort and cooperation that Pakistan and the United States are making jointly. This may be election season in the United States, but it should not be at our expense.
In Burma, human rights activist Koh Myint Nang has been sentenced to 8 years in prison. The military-led Burma regime accused him of inciting unrest in an incident that saw him and other activists attacked by a pro-government mob. Myint Nang was on his way to a human rights training session. The Burmese government has been accused of scores of human rights abuses and arbitrary detentions since taking power. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the U.S. has opted to take a hands-off approach to a Saudi bank U.S. intelligence has linked to the financing of militant Islamic extremists. The Al-Rajhi Bank is among vast holdings belonging to Saudi billionaire Sulaiman Al-Rajhi. The bank's activities reportedly set off an intense debate within the Bush administration on how to take action. But confidential reports show the administration has ultimately chosen to quietly lobby Saudi monarchs rather than take punitive steps. The U.S. intelligence says Al-Rajhi Bank has held accounts and accepted donations for charities formerly designated as fronts for al-Qaeda or other militant groups. The CIA concluded the Al-Rajhi was knowingly involved. Al-Rajhi Bank and the Al-Rajhi family have denied any link to financing militants. The disclosure comes as the Bush administration is facing criticism for prosecuting the largest Islamic charity in the United States. In a trial that began this week, prosecutors accused the Texas-based Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development of providing millions of dollars in funding to militant activities by Hamas. The charity says the money has gone to Palestinian victims of Israeli attacks and closures in the occupied territories. The case is one of the largest of its kind in U.S. history. Prosecutors have faced scrutiny for heavily relying on secret evidence supplied by the Israeli government. Khalil Meek of the Muslim Legal Fund of America said, quote, the Bush administration is arguing providing medical and nutritional assistance to sick and starving Palestinian children amounts to supporting terrorism. In economic news, the Justice Department has launched an investigation into several alleged cases of discriminatory practices in mortgage lending. The National Community Reinvestment Coalition recently found African Americans are twice as likely as white applicants to receive loans with expensive above-market rates. The investigation follows a class-action lawsuit from the NAACP accusing subprime mortgage lenders of institutionalized systematic racism. Lenders named in the suit include Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and Washington Mutual. And in immigration news, a federal judge has struck down a series of controversial anti-immigrant laws in the Pennsylvania town of Hazleton. Over the last year, the town has adopted ordinances aimed at barring undocumented immigrants from working or renting homes there. Judge James Munley ruled the measures subverted federal immigration laws and violated due process rights of employers, landlords, and undocumented immigrants. Observers say the ruling could have a strong effect in barring other towns from passing similar anti-immigrant measures. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 45 people were arrested on Capitol Hill Monday in a sit-in calling on Democrats to pursue the impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. The demonstrators were jailed after refusing to leave the office of House Judiciary Chair John Conyers following a meeting with him. Conyers had floated the idea of impeachment last year, but House Speaker Nancy Pelosi dismissed the talk during the midterm elections when she declared impeachment off the table. Among those arrested on Monday was Cindy Sheehan. It was less than 2 months ago that she announced she was stepping down as the face of the country's anti-war movement. She cited the draining lifestyle and the lack of public will for ending the Iraq War. Well, Cindy Sheehan is back. She arrived in Washington Sunday following a two-week cross-country march dubbed the Journey for Humanity and Accountability. The tour began in Crawford, Texas. It was there she'd set up the peace camp next to President Bush's Crawford estate 2 summers ago. She named it Camp Casey in honor of her son, Casey Sheehan, killed in Iraq in Sadr City, April 4, 2004. Shortly before her arrest on Monday, Cindy Sheehan confirmed she'll challenge House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for her congressional seat in the next election unless Pelosi agrees to begin the impeachment process, again, the president and the vice president. Although it's rarely discussed in the corporate media, a grassroots movement for impeachment has been rapidly building. A recent poll by the American Research Group found about 45% of the country supports the U.S. House of Representatives beginning impeachment proceedings against Bush and Cheney. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, 15 co-sponsors have signed on to Congressmember Dennis Kucinich's bill of impeachment against Vice President Cheney, and more than 80 towns and cities have passed pro-impeachment resolutions. Well, today we'll look at the impeachment movement. Cindy Sheehan joins us in our New York studio. We're also joined here by Democratic strategist Dan Gerstein. He's a former aide to Senator Joseph Lieberman and a regular columnist at the website Politico. He recently wrote a column entitled "Impeachment Question Divides Democrats." Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern also joins us from Washington. He was arrested along with Cindy Sheehan Monday at Congressman Conyers' office. He is co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Cindy Sheehan, first, well, I spoke to you when you announced your basically retirement as the public face of the peace movement in this country. What happened?
Well, you know, and on your show, I did say that we were almost doing this, like, closing up the factory, retooling, and we were going to come back stronger and in a new direction. We didn't plan on coming back with our new organization, People for Humanity, until August. We're going to Jordan and Syria to visit Iraqi refugee camps to expose those crimes against humanity of the Bush administration. The refugee crisis in the Middle East is a disaster. It's a humanitarian crisis. And when George Bush commuted Scooter Libby's sentence, we came back sooner than we expected. And we started our journey on July 10th from Crawford, symbolically walking away from that part of our activism to a new part. And I announced before we left that if Nancy Pelosi didn't put impeachment on the table, I would run against her as an independent in California's 8th.
And you have announced?
We announced informally right after the meeting with John Conyers on Monday, and I will announce formally next week from the district.
Why do you feel impeachment is so important?
Well, you know, like Dan said, why don't we elect a Democratic president in 08 and they take office in 09? Hundreds of our soldiers, thousands of Iraqi people will be killed by then. There'll be least chance for stabilization of the Middle East if we wait that long. I believe that impeachment is necessary to restore rule of law to this country, but to also, in the future, prevent abuses of executive power. And when Dan said that it would harm Democrats' chances for taking over the White House, that's not even historically correct. And in my lifetime, we've had two impeachment proceedings, and Clinton's impeachment, although he was impeached in the House and he wasn't found guilty in the Senate, a Republican took office the very next term, and after Nixon, a Democrat took office in the very next term. So if our congresspeople step out in humanity and do the right thing instead of the politically expedient thing, where we took over 1 million signatures to John Conyers on petitions demanding impeachment. While we were there, he was getting one call every 30 seconds. And we know that the majority of the country wants Dick Cheney impeached, and almost a majority wants George Bush impeached. So I think we would stand behind them.
Dan Gerstein, you're the former aide to the independent senator of Connecticut, Joseph Lieberman. You're now right for Politico, the website. Your thoughts?
Well, I think what the impeachment movement has done is produced a very strong indictment of the Bush administration's record, from the disastrous war in Iraq to the NSA surveillance program to the damaging, incredibly damaging work they've done to our standing in the world. What I don't think they've done is provided a compelling case or compelling evidence that President Bush has committed high crimes and misdemeanors. I think we have to ask ourselves two important questions if we're going to pursue impeachment. Is there a strong case that they committed high crimes and misdemeanors? And secondly, and more importantly, I think, is it going to be in the best interest of the country, our government, and the American people? I think on the latter question, as I said in your billboard, the most important thing Democrats can do to take the country in a new direction and repair the damage that the Bush administration has done is to retake the White House in 2008. My personal feeling, and I think a lot of the feeling of a lot of Democrats who are very angry at the Bush administration, nonetheless believe that an impeachment proceeding, A, will not be successful. You need a minimum of 16 Republican senators to convict the president. That's just not going to happen. It's completely unrealistic to think on the evidence that we have now that we're going to be able to convict George Bush. Then, so what is the cost of engaging in that process? Not only will we not be doing the work of the American people for a long time, any chance of ending the war in Iraq, dealing with health care, dealing with a range of issues that are important to the progressive community, completely off the table for the next year. More importantly, I think what it will have, the political effect it will have, will be to galvanize the Republican base, energize them, and really take away a lot of the advantage that Democrats have right now, in large part because the Republicans are split and dispirited. What that does, in essence, is make the 2008 election potentially a jump ball and put at risk our chances of taking the White House back.
Sadie Sheehan.
Well, also in Article 2, Clause 4, it says for treason and bribery and other high crimes and misdemeanors. I believe that, and there's, legal proof out there that when he commuted Scooter Libby's sentence, he committed treason, because Scooter Libby was convicted of obstructing justice in the cover-up of the Bush administration outing Valerie Plame. And I believe that the American people will be behind this. The Democrats aren't trying to end the war. They just gave George Bush $120 billion more to wage it. And he has said the troops aren't coming home while he's president. So I think we need to look at it as human-based and not political. John Conyers told me in a meeting previously to the one we had on Monday that winning the presidency in 08 was more important to him than ending the war in Iraq. When are our leaders going to, I guarantee there's 150,000 mothers in this country who's more important to them to end the war in Iraq and get their children home safely than who's president in 08. And I think historically, when this has impeachment has been tried, like I said before, the party who tried it, even though it hasn't been successful, has galvanized the base of that party to say, wow, our leaders are courageous. Our leaders have integrity. Our leaders are leading us from a moral base, not from political expediency.
Can I just respond to that point real quick? Because I think this goes to the heart of my argument, which is that in 1998, as a matter of fact, that the impeachment effort by the Republicans, which did not have the support of the American people and was completely unjustified, helped galvanize and outrage the Democratic base and in the turnout, so that the first time, I believe in history, that in the sixth year of a two-term president, the president's party picked up seats in a congressional midterm election. That just hasn't happened in American history, and most analysts attribute that to the fact that the Republicans went against the will of the American people and went on this witch hunt against Bill Clinton. So I think that historical parallel suggests to me that there's a real risk if Democrats overreach and pursue a quixotic impeachment process against George Bush, that it will help galvanize the Republican base in a similar
Dan,
way.
Dan, do you think that the Democrats should have tried to impeach Nixon?
Yes, absolutely. And I think there was clearly a much more compelling case that Richard Nixon committed high crimes and misdemeanors on the public record. A, B, the American people believed it, which is not an insignificant part, because no matter what the evidence is, this is a political process, as Cindy knows. And ultimately, you have to have public will on your side, or you have to be able to bring public will to your side. And I don't think in the last year to 18 months of the Bush administration, we're going to be able to pull the American people to a point where they're going to see this as an effort to oust a president who's committed high crimes and misdemeanors, rather than a partisan thing, because this will become very, very partisan.
We're going to break, but we're going to come back to this discussion, and we'll also be joined by the former CIA analyst, Ray McGovern. Cindy Sheehan is our guest, along with Dan Gerstein. He writes for Politico website. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Our leaders should get us into these masses are the ones that need to be held accountable.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country. On Pacifica stations, NPR, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV stations, PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. And our headlines are available in Spanish and transcript and audio form. You can just take them at our website, democracynow.org. We're having a debate on impeachment, whether the Democrats should try to impeach President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. Our guests are Cindy Sheehan, co-founder of Gold Star Families for Peace, Dan Gerstein, a Democratic strategist, political commentator, regular columnist at the website Politico. Ray McGovern is with us in Washington, D.C., the 27-year career CIA analyst, co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Ray McGovern, weigh in here. You've heard Dan Gerstein say this is impractical, that Democrats should be doing the people's business and not get waylaid by impeachment. Cindy Sheehan disagrees. You also got arrested at John Conyers' office.
Yes, Amy, I'd have to profess some unaccustomed humility here before the task. I feel a lot more comfortable talking about communist regimes that have long since imploded than I do about constitutional issues in this country. That having been said, what Cindy says makes a lot of sense to me. It seems to me the argument is between what is politically expedient and what is constitutionally faithful. The Constitution doesn't make any bones about it. There's no subjunctive mood in what Section 4 of Article 2 says. It says the president, the vice president, shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, if people don't realize that there have been high crimes committed by this administration, well, I don't know where they've been. Maybe here I can talk with some authority. I've watched the intelligence being manufactured, being forged, being misrepresented, being made out of whole cloth to justify an unjustifiable war. It's documentarily proved. We have the Downing Street minutes. We know that Saddam Hussein's son-in-law told us in 1995 that all those weapons had been destroyed, and everything he told us turned out to be true. We had recruited, that is, my former colleagues had recruited the acting Iraqi foreign minister, the fellow who was working for Saddam Hussein ostensibly, but had been turned to work for us. When we told the president that the foreign minister said there were no weapons of mass destruction, the president yawned and said, well, thank you very much, that's all I need to hear. And they left with the admonition, please, no more about weapons of mass destruction from this source. It's about regime change. So the evidence is compelling that high crimes have been made. And so what does the Constitution require? Well, this is not, as I say, subjunctive. It's indicative here. The Constitution requires impeachment for such crimes and misdemeanors. And it's Conyers' job to initiate those proceedings. Now, when I asked him about that and sort of gently tried to remind him about that with as much humility as I could summon, given his experience, he said, oh, you know, there have been so many high crimes and misdemeanors around here that that's all my committee would end up doing the whole time is impeaching people. Well, that's not right. That's sort of reductio ad absurdum. That's a rhetorical technique that reduces everything to its most absurd. What needs to happen here is the Democrats have to sort of wake up and say, look, we have a duty. We swore an oath to protect the Constitution of the United States. This is what the Constitution calls for, and we need to do it for basically two reasons. Number one, that no president will ever be allowed to act like a king again. I mean, after all, that's why the founders put impeachment in the Constitution six separate times. They came out of that English experience where kings would march people off to war for their own good, of course, but with their having no say. And so the framers of our Constitution were hell-bent and determined to put in very upfront that no president would have the authority to do this without the explicit approval of the Congress.
Let me ask Dan Gerstein a question. What do you think, what would you believe would be a reason to impeach President Bush?
He's done something that is extra constitutional. He's done something that has completely compromised the trust of the American people to the point that he is no longer fit to be president. You know, part of the problem I have with what Ray has been saying, which is he makes some very appealing and compelling arguments to a point. But I think this idea that the Constitution requires impeachment is deeply flawed. In large part because there is this presumption among people who favor impeachment that the evidence is airtight. It's not airtight. It hasn't persuaded me, and I want George Bush to go. You have a whole rest of the country that doesn't feel as strongly, that is not as well informed. And again, this is a political process. And in a certain sense, the court is not just the Senate, it's the American people. And I think a lot of the evidence that Ray and people in the impeachment movement have assumed shows impeachable offenses was presented to the American people before the 2004 election, and they still reelected George Bush. And I think you can't write that off. I think the other point to make that's very important is this is not just a question of political expedience. I think that is an unfair assertion to sort of minimize and marginalize people who agree with Ray and Cindy that George Bush has been a disastrous president. But there's a real cost here to undergoing impeachment, and that would divide the country and split the Democratic Party, and really, I believe, undermine our ability to, like I said, the most important thing the Democrats can do right now to take the country in a better direction and repair the damage George Bush done is to retake the White House. And then this question about the polling, I've talked to four leading pollsters, two Democrats, two Republicans, about the ARG poll as well as other polling, which has usually shown impeachment somewhere between, I'd say, 35% and 40% among American people. Their belief, very strong belief and interpretation of that data, is that it shows an exhaustion, a fatigue with George Bush. The American people want him to go. And that's the extent to what that shows. That once you pushed people and said, this is what impeachment is, this is what the burden is, and this is what would happen to the country, their belief is those numbers would go down dramatically.
What's the difference between Nixon and Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos, and Bush and Iraq?
Richard Nixon was not impeached for Cambodia. He was impeached for obstruction of justice and crimes to cover up actions he's done that were about self-aggrandizement, about his personal power. I've reviewed a lot of the, you know, supposed evidence or charges against George Bush. Regardless of whether they were bad for the country, they were not about consolidating his personal power. They were not for to protect his, you know, not about his self-interest. And I think that's a major distinction.
Cindy Sheehan.
I think we have, this is our fundamental difference. We do believe that it was to consolidate power. We believe that, you know, I know that Richard Nixon, doesn't matter if I believe it or not, was impeached for using his power to punish enemies. That's what they did to Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame. George Bush has broken the Supremacy Clause, Article 6. George Bush has broken the Eighth Amendment, authorizing torture, the Fourth Amendment by imprisoning people without their due process. He's taken away our rights to habeas corpus. He adds signing statements to every law he disagrees with. It's about consolidating all power in the executive branch, and impeachment is about restoring our system of checks and balances.
But I guess at the end of the day, will that effectively restore the rule of law to try to impeach George Bush? If it fails, I'm concerned about the precedent it sets if it fails.
Congress has been busy giving away their power to George Bush for the last 7 years.
Well, that's something.
They gave away their power to declare war. They gave away their power to write laws. And he has taken the Supreme Court's power to enforce these laws. And I think that, yes, I think that if Congress steps up and does one thing that is constitutionally correct, it will go a long way to restoring the balance of power.
But I think, Cindy, one thing we can definitely agree on is that Congress has been too timid in holding Bush administration accountable. I don't think, though, that that justifies going to the compensatory extreme of an impeachment process. And to go to a point Ray raised about deterrence, which is an argument that you hear over repeatedly from the impeachment movement, I think what happened with President Johnson in Vietnam, and then Richard Nixon, and now George Bush, this idea that, you know, by just beginning impeachment proceedings against George Bush, you're going to deter future presidents from engaging similar actions, I think is just unrealistic, because, the Nixon case proves it. If you're comparing George Bush to what Nixon did, the fact that there was an impeachment proceeding begun against him, he was forced to leave office, that had a deterrent effect, I just think that's not going to happen. Future presidents, if they believe what they're doing is in the interest of the country, which, you know, frankly, I think a lot of people in the Bush administration believe it is, whether that is true or not, they're not going to be deterred.
I think if Congress had impeached Ronald Reagan for Iran-Contra, we might have had a deterrent effect. I think that if we don't impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney, they've made a mockery of the Constitution. They've trampled on it. If we don't impeach them, take out the clauses, or just we'll just forget we have a Constitution in this and a representative republic.
Ray McGovern, what would an impeachment look like? What exactly do you feel that President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney, and would this happen at exactly the same time, be charged with?
Well, Amy, I had the good fortune to be at the House Judiciary Committee session at which the three articles of impeachment were voted against President Nixon. I waited for 4 hours around the block, finally got in, and my luck was that I was there when it happened. There were three charges, one of which George Bush has already admitted to, and that is illegal wiretapping. Mm-hmm. He's bragged about it. Mm-hmm. He said that he's reauthorized that program 30 times. It's clearly against the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and it's against the Fourth Amendment, and the federal judge out there in Detroit has said so. So that's one. Subpoenas, defying subpoenas, that was another charge against President Nixon. So even if you're not going to go for the real charges, the felonies, the high crimes of starting wars on false pretenses, you've got these slightly lesser abuses that you could simply begin with and say, well, now, Mr. President, you admit having authorized this illegal wiretapping. What was it all about? Now, there's a lot of stuff going on about all that right now in Washington, but they're going after the small fry. And meanwhile, as Cindy points out, people are dying. People are dying every day. Eight Americans died today. And when people come up to me and say, as one has, look, Mr. McGovern, we need the oil, don't we? I say, yeah, we do. He said, well, you know, I have to admit that HEIs on a given day is a pretty small price to pay for the oil that we need. After all, in Vietnam, we had maybe 20 or 30 killed every day. Well, you know, I think subconsciously, Amy, I think subconsciously, that's the way a lot of Americans feel. They're susceptible to this appeal to watch for our way of life. That's what they're after. They're after our way of life. And so we have to get real, and we have to say, is it worth sacrificing the lives of eight young men and women on a given day so that we can pretend to have some rights to the oil that happens to lie under the sands of Iran?
Dan Gerstein.
Well, I think what Ray just said kind of reveals what's at the heart of the impeachment movement. It's not a constitutional movement. It's a political movement. And it's an effort to stop the war. Now, I admire the principle behind that. They feel that this war is so disastrous that they will do anything to stop George Bush from continuing it. I just think that is not a compelling argument to start this extremely, extremely rare and purposely extremely rare process of trying to remove a sitting president. And not just remove a sitting president, but remove him less than 18 months before his term is up. And, you know, I think that the impeachment, people who support impeachment have to step back and sort of say, is this realistic, A? B, will it accomplish the goals they want, B? And C, more importantly, will it stop the war? And I don't think it will. I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that by going on this move, which I think will actually galvanize the Republican Party behind President Bush when his approval ratings are so low right now, they're all running away from him.
So, Dan, let me ask you something. You're the former aide to Senator Lieberman. Senator Lieberman is one of the chief voices for this war. He's not calling for it to end.
He is not calling for it to end.
Your thoughts. Do you disagree with him?
You're asking my personal view. I think the war was a mistake.
You know, Amy, too, there's so many constitutional experts who say that impeachment, you know, we do have a heart. We do love our soldiers and the people of Iraq. But the Center for Constitutional Rights, Bruce Fine, a Republican, so many constitutional experts are calling for impeachment and saying it's constitutionally correct. You know, and just because Ray and I have hearts and want the killing to stop doesn't mean we also don't have brains and think that this is, you know, exactly constitutionally correct.
So how are you planning to execute this? How is this movement moving forward?
We have to get I think it was brilliant on Monday. The American people spoke, and we spoke loudly with over a million signatures, calls to Congressman Conyers' office, calls to Nancy Pelosi's office. And we need a true people's movement in this country, people who will govern us for the people and by the people, not for the corporations and by the corporations. And I think that's what is stymieing Congress right now, is who they're beholden to. So I think people need to run against Republicans and Democrats alike if they're not representing the people. So it has to be a true people's movement.
Ray McGovern, you're the former CIA analyst who is a top briefer for President Bush. That's President George H.W. Bush. Have you been in contact with George W. Bush's father? Do you know his views on this subject?
I have been in contact with him, but not recently. It's a year since I wrote to him. I sense his feelings on this, but I have he's very discreet, of course.
What do you mean you sense his feelings? What communication have you ever had with him on the subject of what's happening today?
Well, I wrote to him very early on and suggested that he ought to tell his son when he gets an opportunity the reasons why Jim Baker and Brent Scowcroft advised him, the father Bush, very strongly to make sure that he kept the crazies, in quotes, quote, the crazies, end quote, at levels of authority where they couldn't put the country at grave risk. I'm talking about the Pearls and the Wolfowitzes of this world, the folks that lingered at pretty senior positions in the Pentagon but didn't have the final say. They, of course, came in with Bush the son and were not only, well, they were all over the place. They were running the policy. And so I just suggested to him that he had very good reasons for doing that. He escaped what happened to his son, and maybe he could just remind him why it was good to keep these people at arm's length. I got a very short response saying that he was very proud of his son and that he would he referred to the crazies, in quotes, in his note to me, so those people who doubt that that's how we referred to these folks, you know, I have some documentary proof of that. But I'm sure that, you know, speaking through Scowcroft and Baker before the war and since, he must be distraught at what's happening. It's just really amazing.
Let me ask you one other question, and that is, yes, Nixon, they didn't attempt to impeach him for Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos. It was about cover-up. But what about that, that usually impeachment is not about the highest crimes? Cindy, what about that?
Well, I think that that would have been a deterrent. I've spoken at length to Liz Holtzman, a former congresswoman from New York who was on that, and she wrote, and her and Congressman Robert Drinan wrote the clauses to impeach him for Cambodia and Laos, and they didn't go through because I think that Congress didn't want to constrain the power of a president in wartime, but I think it needs to be constrained. And our founders wanted it to be constrained. They were afraid of an imperial presidency. And I think if that article had made it to impeachment, then it could restrain future presidents.
How does it feel to be back, Cindy Sheehan?
You know, I feel healthy and strong and ready to rumble and rested, and my reserves are filled up again, so...
Cindy Sheehan, co-founder of Gold Star Families for Peace. Dan Gerstein, Democratic strategist, political commentator, regular columnist at the website Politico. Ray McGovern, 27-year career analyst with the CIA, co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. I want to thank you all for being with us. And if you would like to weigh in here, you can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Or just go to our website, democracynow.org, and you can figure out how to send us mail. We'll read some of that on the air. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to Oaxaca, Mexico. Stay with us.
Great
El día 14 de junio del año del 2006, en la plaza de Oaxaca, se puso el mundo al revés. Temprano por la mañana, al punto de amanecer, nadie hubiera imaginado lo que iba a suceder.
La huelga del magisterio tenía la plaza tomada, mientras el pinche gobierno preparaba la celada. Antes que amanezca el día,
dónde son, que son de la barricada, de dónde son, que de dónde son, que son de la barricada, de dónde son, que de dónde son, que son de la barricada, de dónde, dónde, dónde son, que son de la barricada.
Sonó la alerta en la calle, por donde entró el regimiento, y atrás de la barricada se alborotó el campamento. Más tardaron en llegar que luego en salir corriendo, porque la gente en la plaza ya se estaba defendiendo.
Salieron de todos lados con palos, gritos y piedras, y a toda la policía la mandaron a la mierda. Después vino el contraataque de tierra y aire, con gas que los maestros se quitaron con vinagre.
¿Que de dónde son? ¿Que de dónde son? Que son de la barricada. ¿De dónde son? ¿Que de dónde son? Que son de la barricada. ¿Y de dónde son? ¿Que de dónde son?
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Tensions are high in Oaxaca. Mexico. That's where Oaxaca, the site of the tension is. More than a year after the state's bloody crackdown on striking school teachers led to a popular uprising against Governor Ulysses Ruiz. This week, the Oaxacan state began staging its official celebration, the most important indigenous folk festival in Oaxaca. Since last year, the festival has become a flashpoint of the struggle between popular movements in the state. Last month, the Teachers Union in Apo, the popular assembly of the peoples of Oaxaca, voted to reclaim the event from corporate and state control. They planned to hold a free celebration early last week as an alternative to the official Coca-Cola-sponsored event aimed at tourists. Thousands of people marched down the streets last Monday demanding the resignation of the deeply unpopular state governor. Governor Ruiz is widely held responsible for leaving the violent deaths of some 25 protesters last year unpunished. In response to last week's gathering, the governor sent in hundreds of heavily armed state police to prevent the popular celebration from taking place. The police attacked the crowds, and reports indicate at least 70 people were arrested, 40 were seriously wounded. Emeterio Cruz Vasquez, a 46-year-old plumber and spouse of a striking teacher, died from his wounds. Human Rights Watch urged Oaxacan state officials to investigate allegations of excessive police violence against the demonstrators. Today, we find out more about the popular struggles and demands in the embattled region of Oaxaca. We'll be joined in the Firehouse studio by Oaxaca-based activists and filmmakers Damian Flores and Simon Cedillo. But first, we turn to veteran independent journalist, activist, and intellectual Gustavo Esteva, who joins us on the phone from Oaxaca. He's the founder of the University of the Earth in Oaxaca, Universidad de la Tierra, and has been a columnist for the Mexican newspaper La Jornada. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Gustavo Esteva.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Explain what is happening now in Oaxaca.
Well, basically, my feeling is that the mood of the people today is that we are hoping for the best, but we are preparing for the worst, because the last Monday, the people gave magnificent signs of courage and restraint, and at the same time, we got signs of incompetence, irresponsibility, and a very dangerous attitude in the state and the federal government. What we are seeing basically is that they have been training the police, both the municipal, the state, and the federal police, in an exercise of clear impunity. This was very clear, very open in the repression 15 days ago in July 16th, when they were very vicious in the open repression of the people. Even with journalists there, in front of a journalist that were also beaten, and telling them, you can do whatever you want, you can take photos, you can do whatever they want. And they have this feeling of impunity, because they know very well, we all know, that, for example, the killers of Brad Will, those that we had in the video, are in their public offices. They are officers. There is not one single case of any police or any person even accused doing anything against them, in spite of the fact that we have all kind of documentation, proofs, the local organizations of human rights, the international organizations, we have all kind of elements. The federal government are still saying that they will not intervene, that this is a local affair, but at the same time, it is only the federal government that can authorize the use of the army. And the army, in this occasion, last Monday, they stopped buses in the roads, and they were in the hills where the events happened. Then the federal government is intervening, is still supporting this psychopathic governor, and supporting this repression of the social movements. Apparently, they'll continue trying to give the lessons to the people of Oaxaca and to the people of the whole country that they are ready to pay the political price of these open violations of human rights, this obscene treatment of the social movements, to keep the people in control.
Gustavo Esteva with us in Oaxaca. We are also joined by two Oaxaca-based activist filmmakers, Damian Flores and Simon Cedillo. Damian is a media activist, works with a collective that came together during the 2006 popular uprising in Oaxaca. He was a collaborator on Compromiso Cumplido, or True to My Pledge, the first of a two-part documentary about human rights violations by the state during the current conflict in Oaxaca. Simon Cedillo is an activist and filmmaker, has been working in and out of Oaxaca for the last 8 years, documenting and teaching community-based video to indigenous communities. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Why don't we start off with Damian? Can you describe what your film collective is attempting to do right now? And I also want to alert our viewers and listeners, you can go to our website at democracynow.org to see some of the video of what's taking place on the ground right now in Oaxaca. Damian. Simon, can you translate for Damian? Thank you.
¿Qué está haciendo el colectivo de Mal de Ojo?
Pues el colectivo de Mal de Ojo TV es desde el inicio del 14 de junio empezó a documentar pues el proceso del movimiento social oaxaqueño y hasta ahorita pues siguen trabajando en el proceso de la documentación y también de la información de lo que sigue pasando en la capital.
So my collective Mal de Ojo TV began since the 14th of June 2006 when Ulises began his repression against the popular movement. We began documenting the social uprising and social organizing around these issues and have been doing so since then.
And explain the name Mal de Ojo.
Explica el nombre.
Mal de Ojo, pues básicamente nació como en la coyuntura, es un nombre como más así puesto, porque estábamos juntados, somos básicamente el colectivo, es la unión de varios colectivos de medios que trabajan en Oaxaca y gente que venía de fuera, gente que trabaja con colectivos.
So Mal de Ojo came out of a collective process, Spanish for the evil eye, and we just collectively came together and came up with that name. Mm-hmm.
How hard is it to film in the streets?
¿Qué tan difícil es grabar en las calles?
Ha sido un proceso bien difícil. Al principio del movimiento era difícil hasta con la gente misma del movimiento popular. Era como la gente desconfiaba de los medios, cualquier medio. Y no se sabe la diferencia entre un medio comercial, un medio alternativo, independiente.
So at first it was obviously very difficult, and it's always very difficult, but at first the people on the streets didn't know the difference between necessarily independent media activists and regular media, so people had very little trust of mainstream media because they had been kind of manipulating the story in the mainstream media.
Entonces, para tener como un gafete, una identificación como medio independiente, tenías que pensarlo. Si era bueno o malo, porque también podría ser, es malo por usarlo con la policía porque hay mucha persecución de los medios, y bueno para usarlo con la gente porque te reconoce el trabajo.
And then we also have the constant issue of deciding whether or not to use an independent media press badge, because it's good to have that for the people to identify you as an independent journalist, but it's bad for the police to identify you as an independent journalist.
And Simone, you yourself are working on a film now that is edited by indigenous communities. Can you talk about the role of communities, the media in the communities? I mean, community last year, APO taking over a radio station, so they have some means to speak unfiltered to the people.
Absolutely. I think more than anything, it's important to understand it's a very broad-based movement, not just a teachers' movement, but an indigenous movement, workers, students, housewives, a lot of different people involved. And everybody traditionally has noticed the manipulation of mass media in Mexico. It's very blatant. It's very easy and to point out and recognize. So independent media and taking back the media was an integral component of the APO's uprising. One of the most important tools that they utilized was radio. A radio station that was controlled by the Section 22 teachers movement was actually shut down by the police on June 14th. Immediately, the APO occupied the university radio station, Radio Universidad, and held it for the entirety of the popular uprising. They also occupied the state-run TV and radio station, Canal 9, and at one point had occupied 11 commercial radio stations, which little by little were returned. But all this became a very, very integral component to the entire uprising.
Gustavo Esteva, Brad Will, you mentioned, the American journalist who was killed last year in Oaxaca as he was covering the conflict. Other Oaxacans were also killed, not as well known in this country. And this year, the person who was just killed now in this latest conflict.
And in this specific case, well, in fact, as in most of the other 26 cases that we have documented and those that we cannot document because the people are intimidated to report the dead, those disappeared. But the fact is that this last case, we have a very, very serious series of photos and a video showing very clearly that when the police got this guy, he was in perfect condition. He was walking in, and he has not any sign of any kind of problem, meaning that this was not in a conflict, this was not in a battle, that he was not attacking the police. He was just captured, and then after capturing him, they started beating him.
Gustavo Esteva, I want to end with a clip from the documentary Compromiso Cumplido, or True to My Pledge, just released. Damian Flores worked on the production. This is an excerpt.
Everything started in these neighborhoods due to insecurity. People started setting up their barricades. One day my husband said, "We're just sitting here resting, and these people are risking their lives and losing sleep in the barricades." He said, "Why don't you make a pot of coffee and we'll take it there?" On October 14th, he said, "Why don't you make an oatmeal atole with bread, and we'll take it to our friends in the barricade." When it was around 2:30, he said, "Well, let's get going." And I said, "Yes, let's go." We were just turning here to go home when suddenly we heard the sirens of an ambulance. He said, "Let's go open a path for the ambulance to get through." He went back to do it, and I just stood there. I saw a truck that had been parked for a while in front of a bar, got ahead of the ambulance, and went over to the barricade. I heard the shots while they were shouting, "Long live Ulysses Ruiz." They started firing. I went back to see what had happened, and they told me that my husband was wounded. I found him on the ground in the middle of the street, drowning in his own blood.
Excerpt of Compromiso Cumplido. You can go to maldoorjotv.net. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shrufa Budukadush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Pressar, Matei, Anjali Kamat, Jay Babalota, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Kari Mache, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, engineers. A very fond farewell to Tori Townsend. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.